Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this facility. Senator Michaela Cash makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's very well known throughout Australia, but I will introduce her briefly. She was she's graduated in law and in arts and studied in universities in London and Curtin and UWA in Western Australia. She worked as a lawyer. Most importantly, from our point of view, she was elected in the 2007 election and took her position in the Senate from the middle of 2008. And currently, Senator Cash is the Minister for Employment, Minister for Women, and Minister assisting the Prime Minister for the Public Service. And tonight, Senator Cash is going to talk on the topic, Fighting for the Forgotten People, 75 years on. Senator Cash, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Sorry to the people down the back there. It really is an absolute delight to be here and join you tonight as the Minister for Employment at the Sydney Institute, but in particular to address you in relation to fighting for the forgotten people 75 years on. Gerard Henderson is, of course, famous within this portfolio for first coining the phrase the Industrial Relations Club way back in 1983, and I can see some heads nodding. In the decades since, the phrase and the concept has become an integral component of any debates in the industrial relations policy. Gerard and Anne Henderson have also written extensively over many, many years about the history and the philosophy of the conservative side of politics. Few individuals have a deeper understanding of the origins and the history of the Liberal Party. In 1994, Gerard published what was, at that stage, possibly the first ever attempt at a comprehensive history of the Liberal Party, entitled Menzies' Child. This was a book marking the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Liberal Party by Sir Robert Menzies in 1944. In 2017, we will mark a very important 75th anniversary. On the 22nd of May, it will be 75 years since the most famous of Menzies' Forgotten People series of speeches. In 1942, in the midst of a war, Robert Menzies articulated what it was that would keep Australia standing tall and who it was that gave Australia its backbone. Amongst many memorable comments in this speech, he declared that in Australia, the class war must always be a false war. 75 years on, it is instructive to reflect on what Menzies observed in relation to those who have power and influence and those who don't. He observed that there were some people who controlled great funds and enterprises. They were those that we would now call the business community, which he described as able to protect themselves, though it must be said that in a political sense, they have shown as a rule neither comprehension nor competence. Other people, he said, were politically well organised. Then, as now, the labour movement has always viewed disciplined organisation as the key to applying political pressure. He identified a third group: salary earners, shopkeepers, skilled artisans, professional men and women, farmers, among others, whom he famously described as the forgotten people. They were, in Menzies' words, unorganised and unselfconscious, not rich enough to wield power in its own right, and too individualistic for pressure politics. And yet, they were the backbone of the nation. Menzies said the real life of this nation wasn't found in great luxury hotels and the petty gossip of fashionable suburbs or in the officialdom of organised masses. These days, he might observe that the real spirit of the Australian people is not manifested in corporate boardrooms, campaigns for fashionable causes, the corridors of Canberra, hashtag activists on Twitter, or posturers on Q&A. The real life of Australia was then, and is now, to be found in the homes of those whom Menzies praised as nameless and unadvertised Australians. For the past 18 months, I have had the absolute privilege of being the Minister for Employment. In this portfolio, as many of you would know, there are competing demands and sometimes conflicts between powerful sectional interests and those who do not have power and influence. They were championed by Menzies as the forgotten people. Today, they are at risk of becoming the expendable people. Often the Liberal Party is typecast by its critics as the party of big business. We are, however, the party of mainstream Australia. Mainstream Australia values independence, self-reliance, and aspiration. Aspiration in this context means the belief that Australia is the kind of place in which anyone who works hard and plays by the rules can enjoy well-earned success and build a better future for their children. This belief reflects the inherent confidence that Australia is the kind of place that will always reward those who Menzies described as the strivers, the planners, the ambitious ones. It was in this context that the Liberal Party took to the last election several policies in the employment portfolio, which starkly distinguished us from the Labor opposition. We promised to address the bullying and lawlessness in the building and construction industry. We promised to make unions more transparent and accountable and stop union bosses exploiting hard-working, honest union members. We promised to protect the 60,000 members of the Country Fire Authority in Victoria. And of course, the thousands of mum and dad owner-operator truck drivers. Regrettably, in honouring each of these commitments, which we have done, Labor not only refused to work with us, they fervently worked against us. Call me cynical, but perhaps the explanation can be found in the fact that last year the unions donated $10 million to the ALP and spent a further $16 million on their own campaign to get Labor elected. Menzies would certainly recognise today's union movement as the same movement of organised pressure politics of 1942. But he would not recognise its modern-day financial influence. In 1942, when Menzies spoke of those who controlled great funds and enterprises, he was referring to corporate Australia. In 2017, the term is equally applicable to the union movement. Allow me to now provide some contemporary examples of where the Turnbull government has remembered and stood up for today's forgotten people. Early last year, my office and I started receiving calls from distressed truck drivers, men and women, pleading for help. Their livelihoods were being threatened and their lives turned upside down because of a decision by a body called the Road Safety Remuneration Tribunal, established by Bill Shorten as Workplace Relations Minister in 2012. Now, a tribunal to improve road safety sounds innocuous. Indeed, it sounds almost harmless. But behind the Orwellian name lie a Machiavellian motive. In truth, the establishment of this tribunal had nothing to do with safety. Rather, it was a brutal power grab on behalf of the Transport Workers' Union, but at the expense of 35,000 self-employed owner drivers. The tribunal had passed a payments order dictating so-called safe rates of pay that applied only to owner drivers. This clearly discriminated against small family businesses, often based in regional Australia. In fact, what it did was make them unviable. The tribunal's decision would have imposed a radically new pay structure on the owner drivers. It would have meant, for example, if a livestock carrier picked up a partial load from multiple farmers, they would have had to have charged each farmer the prescribed full rates as if for a full load. This prescriptive approach clearly would not work for such a diverse industry. But the reality was, it was never meant to. It was intended to force owner drivers to join a big union and drive for a big company. And if they didn't do that, then not drive at all. As the effects of the tribunal's decision kicked in, some family businesses laid off staff or sold equipment. Some left the industry. Others wanted to leave the industry, but they couldn't because they could not get a fair price for their truck in what had become a flooded market. Within the space of a few weeks, I travelled around Australia and I met hundreds and hundreds of owner drivers. They were, to say the least, the most upright, salt-of-the-earth Australians you could ever meet. To the government, they were Menzies, quintessential forgotten people, doing their best to go about their business, provide for their family, and pay their bills. But they were suddenly in need of defending from those Menzies would have described as the politically well-organised. For those who had devised this tribunal, they were the expendable people. People who simply did not fit their view of the world and had no political significance except to potentially become another member of the TWU. 2 weeks after the order took effect, to the relief of these owner drivers, we secured the Senate numbers to abolish Bill Shorten's tribunal. This was in no way thanks to Labor or the Greens, who fought the owner drivers every step of the way. It was to my great relief that in the following days, my office again started receiving calls from the truckies, this time saying, "Michaela, we're giving you the thumbs up, we're back on the road again." Shortly after this sorry episode, we saw a similar political grab for power threatening volunteer firefighters in Victoria's Country Fire Authority. Now, for those of you who know the CFA, you know that it is one of the largest and most effective emergency service volunteer organisations in the world. Anyone who has lived in Victoria has either been touched by bushfires or knows someone who has been touched by bushfires. They appreciate that the role of the CFA is intrinsic to Victorian life. Its 60,000 volunteers personify our national character and represent the very best of Australian values. But last year, a dark political cloud was cast over the future of this quintessentially Australian organisation. The Victorian Labor government tried to ram through an enterprise agreement containing clauses described by a former Labor emergency services minister as Trojan horses to sideline CFA volunteers by handing over its management to the United Firefighters Union. This plan included interfering with the CFA's chain of command, requiring union agreement before the CFA could change its internal policies, and even requiring volunteer firefighters and paid firefighters to wear different uniforms. Even community engagement and education, which for 70 years had been conducted by these amazing volunteers who are trusted in their communities, that was also to be union controlled. The CFA's former chief executive, she said she could not stay and oversee the destruction of the CFA, and she resigned. Even Labor's Emergency Services Minister, Jane Garrett, felt compelled to resign. The CFA board refused to accept the agreement, and so they were sacked by the Andrews government. And despite this agreement having huge implications for the 60,000 volunteers of the CFA, they had no say in it. For the sake of a deal, they were cast aside. A further example of Labor's expendable people, forgotten in favour of a union deal. When the Prime Minister and I met numerous volunteers of all ages at Coldstream, northeast of Melbourne, we were greeted by a 71-year-old CFA veteran, Don Bigham. Following in his parents' footsteps, Don had actually joined the CFA when he was a teenager. After 55 years of service, including 18 years as a brigade captain, he was still active in the CFA, along with his wife and daughter. Don, like thousands of other CFA members, dedicated their lives to the service of their community. Why? Well, because as Don said to me, it's just what we do. In August last year, the Turnbull government successfully amended the Fair Work Act to protect the operations of emergency services volunteer bodies. We stood up for those who would otherwise truly have become the expendable people. One of the two double dissolution trigger bills of 2016 was the bill to reinstate the Australian Building and Construction Commission to properly enforce workplace laws on building sites. Now, the debate in relation to the ABCC is often conducted in abstract terms of statistics dealing with industrial dispute levels and productivity. However, in reality, the debate is actually one about hard-working people. Hard-working, law-abiding people who have been forgotten and overlooked. Since becoming the Employment Minister, I have met and received, I cannot tell you how many representations from self-employed tradies and medium-sized builders. Unfortunately, due to the bullying, intimidation and thuggery that they are subjected to in this industry by big building unions, they have to remain anonymous. Let me, however, quote from a typical letter or a conversation or a meeting that I have had with these people. In relation to the letter, I've even had to change certain details to ensure that no one can identify this particular employer. I was previously the owner of a building contracting company employing approximately 30 to 40 workers and apprentices. I was approached by the union and asked to sign a union-based enterprise agreement. I spoke to all of our employees who supported me in standing up against this union, as they were more than happy with the company's agreement. I relayed this information to the union official, who then stated that unless I signed, he would make sure that we are never awarded another contract. I still refused to be bullied. So the union set up picket lines at projects we were involved in and stopped my employees from entering the sites. Eventually, to be able to complete the projects, I reluctantly agreed to the union demands and signed their agreement. Unfortunately, the financial damage was done. I myself lost all of my assets
and was subsequently forced into bankruptcy by the ATO. No one ever really recovers from these types of actions from union standover men. This letter speaks for countless other small operators in the industry who have been threatened with or suffered a similar fate. Given these types of actions, though, it is probably just the tip of the iceberg that the CFMEU currently has 110 representatives before the courts, which, as you know, in recent years, have imposed over $8 million in fines on the unions and its officials for breaches of the law. However, what we also know is, despite this, this has clearly not been enough to act as a deterrence. For both the CFMEU and the ACTU's new secretary, Sally McManus, breaking the law is perfectly acceptable if you don't like the particular law. Their attitude, however, ignores the fact that laws are not abstractions. They are there to protect actual people. When unions break the law, these are not victimless crimes. The people who suffer from union lawlessness are the individual workers and the small subcontractors who, in any other line of work, think about yourself and what you do, would reasonably expect the power of the Australian state to protect them from lawbreakers. Many of these affected people are not so much Menzies' forgotten people, they are the invisible people, because they are too frightened of recriminations from thuggish unions to speak up and expose how things really are in their industry. They needed a strong voice in government, and we gave them one. Cleaning up the building and construction industry is critical for its 1.1 million workers and the 300,000 small businesses which rely on a fair system where rules actually mean something. It's also critical for taxpayers because the high level of industrial disputes in construction, which is currently six times the average, adds around 30% to the costs of roads, to the cost of schools, to the cost of hospitals and other vital infrastructure. These extra costs, though, are not just due to union misconduct, but also to the large head contractors that engage in cartel-like conduct with big unions, that inflate their costs and impose these costs on smaller subcontractors and taxpayers. After the ABCC was abolished by Bill Shorten in 2012, the rate of industrial disputes in the construction industry increased by 47%, while disputes declined by 31% in the rest of the economy. Unfortunately, no one keeps statistics on the number of subcontractors who are bullied, intimidated, denied work, or forced out of the business by building union tactics. As a government, we had a responsibility to act, and we did, and as you know, the ABCC has now been restored. But I am sorry to say that it has not yet fully changed the prevailing culture. Further reform is desperately needed to protect the invisible people and to deal with those who think breaking the law is simply a game in which no one gets hurt. Further evidence of Labor's contempt for small business can be found in what can only be described as their hypocritical reaction to the Independent Fair Work Decisions Commission to modify Sunday penalty rates. An inconvenient fact that Labor never mentions is that many big businesses already pay lower Sunday penalty rates through enterprise agreements that they've negotiated with unions. Small businesses, however, the backbone of our economy, they don't have this option. So this means, just for example, to hire permanent staff on Sundays, suburban greengrocer, we all have one of them, has got to pay $5 more per hour than Woolworths. A family-owned takeaway must pay $8 more per hour than McDonald's. A bed and breakfast must pay $10 more per hour than a five-star hotel. So when I look at that, I think let's be really clear about Bill Shorten and his hypocrisy. As a union boss, he quite frankly made an art form about in doing deals with employers to trade away or completely cut the penalty rates of workers. He's happy for big businesses to be able to do deals with big unions that trade away or abolish penalty rates. But when the Independent Fair Work Commission makes a decision to modify slightly penalty rates that has a positive impact on small business, that ultimately evens up the playing field, then he has an issue with that. Those opposed to the decision of the independent umpire would do well to actually listen to what the various businesses told the Commission during its review, because they are typical of thousands of workplaces across Australia. Mr. Gough, for example. Now, he is the owner of a specialty deli in Ballina. He employs 20 people. Fantastic. But due to high Sunday penalty rates, guess what Mr. Gough does? He works on Sundays in his deli for free. He told the Commission, this was his evidence, that with moderate changes, he could open the store's bakery on Sunday, work fewer unpaid hours, and pay for more staff. And then we had the evidence given by a man named David, who owns a pharmacy in Kilborra Beach, where he knows he provides an invaluable service to the community, including the local retirement village. This is the evidence that he gave to the Commission. With moderate changes to penalty rates, he could open and employ staff every day except Christmas. Hotel owners from Fitzroy to Broken Hill to Rockhampton, they all said that they had been reducing trading hours, cutting shifts, or working on Sundays unpaid. These small businesses believe moderate changes will improve customer service and create jobs. It's very rare that their voices are heard in national debates, and yet they represent the vast majority of employers in this country. And it's vital that their voices are now not drowned out and they do not also become expendable people. Despite the decline in union membership, trade unions continue to have a very legitimate role. However, with the responsibilities that they hold, they have to be transparent and accountable. And contrary to now what is being said by the new ACTU president and the Australian Greens and a number of other union leaders, they must abide by the law. In terms of examples of where union leaders have not done the right thing by their hard-working members, the systematic pillaging of the Health Services Union by various senior officials reflected an attitude that the rules just don't apply to union bosses. And then we have documented similar incidences at the NWU and the AWU, which show that what we saw at the HSU was not just an isolated example. Together, these union leaders fleeced millions of dollars from some of our lowest paid workers. For these union bosses, their members really were the expendable people. Across Australia, there are 47 unions and 63 employer groups that receive annual revenue of $1.3 billion and own or control $2.2 billion in assets. And for those of you who don't know, they also pay $0 in tax. They are indeed, in Menzies' words, great funds and enterprises. In many cases, certain unions are actually bigger and more powerful than the employers that they are negotiating with. They represent more than 2 million members who deserve to know that their organisations are acting in their best interests. It's as simple as that. Last year, as part of our stand against lawlessness in the workplace, The Turnbull government passed legislation to make unions and employer organisations subject to similar governance standards as companies. One might be forgiven for thinking that the party that holds themselves out to be, the party of the worker, may have supported these reforms to achieve honest unions for honest workers. They didn't. And they actually fought us every single step of the way. Last month, we've introduced new legislation, which is now before a Senate committee, to stop secret payments between employers and unions. Whether such payments are for personal gain, whether they're to boost the union coffers, union membership or union influence, or whether they're an employer buying industrial peace. They are a blight on our economy and they impact negatively on law-abiding Australian citizens. If our legislation is passed, only specified, legitimate payments will be allowed. And if you're negotiating an enterprise agreement, you'll need to disclose the payments that have been made to your employees. Again, it's actually as simple as that. These reforms, we believe, will finally clean up the culture of opaque dealings that have often seen both big unions and big employers contrive to sell out the interests of their employees and members through secret deals. Enough is enough. In this respect, when it comes to standing up for honest union workers, I think I can say that it's the Turnbull government that is the best friend that honest union workers have ever had. But we're not standing still. There is still so much more to do, and we will be doing this. We will soon move to introduce additional legislation to enhance integrity and fair dealings in our workplace. That's all we ask for, fair dealings in our workplace. Our measures will include new measures to prevent unions from deliberately falsifying membership records, ensuring union elections are conducted openly and fairly, giving the courts, similar to what happens with company directors, the power to disqualify union officials who repeatedly break the law. As I often say to people, if you don't break the law, you don't need to be worried about what we are putting in place. But also giving the courts the power to deregister or place into administration unions whose leadership has ripped off the members or who have repeatedly broken the law. A strong employment system, though, requires all parties to abide by the law, and that's why we have also introduced legislation to equally deal with unscrupulous employers. And this legislation includes outlawing the appalling practice of cashbacks exposed at 7-Eleven, whereby an employee would receive the right wage only to be walked around the corner and forced to take out money from an ATM. We are outlawing that practice. Increasing penalties tenfold for serious contraventions involving deliberate and systematic underpayment of workers, and holding head officers responsible so they can no longer turn a blind eye to franchisees whom they know are doing the wrong thing. Australians have an acute sense of fairness. We do believe in playing by the rules. In 1983, Gerard Henderson wrote in the Industrial Relations Club that the various members of the club accepted as pragmatic industrial realism that no one would be prosecuted for breaching industrial awards. Jump forward to 2017, and these old attitudes are still yet to be firmly and finally eliminated. But the government is determined to ensure that there are strong laws that are an effective deterrent to those who think nothing of breaking them. Maybe then we will have finally achieved a new province for law and order, when everyone who is subjected to Australia's industrial relations system accepts that obeying the law is not an optional extra. In conclusion, I began this evening by revisiting the words of Robert Menzies 75 years ago and considering what relevance they still have for his successors in the modern Liberal Party. 75 years on, Menzies' words, they still ring true. The various examples that I have cited demonstrate the indifference shown by forces of, as Menzies said, great funds and pressure politics to those who stand in their way and do not have their own organised voices. The forgotten people, the great hard-working, optimistic majority of Australians, they're often at risk of being overlooked in so many of our political contests, but they still are, as Menzies said, the backbone of our nation. Our future lies in the hands of honest, law-abiding, hard-working men and women. It lies in the can-do attitude of small business people. It lies in the love of families and the community spirit of volunteers. It lies in the resilience of those who take on personal responsibility, who refuse to let setbacks deter them from having a go. Australia's future still lies in the instincts and the efforts of the forgotten people. But today, each and every one of us, we have a duty to ensure that they don't now become the expendable people. Thank you.
Many thanks, Minister. So once again, thanks to Coors, Chambers and Westgarth, and we'll go to questions and discussion and finish no later than the top of the hour.
Yeah.
So I will...
do you want me to stand here? Or?
No, you come back here.
Oh, I come back here.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation tonight. A lot of empirical information, but just thinking about it from down there, I mean, what you seem to be talking about is a situation where as union membership in the private sector declines dramatically, that unions are doing what they can to boost union membership in the private sector. So if you go to your penalty rates story, which is an interesting story, let's just take the greengrocer shop, where they pay $5 more on Sunday than McDonald's. And I guess, I like your response to this, I guess the motivation there is that the people at McDonald's are probably members of trade unions, and so the trade unions want them to have a lower rate because there'll be more of them working, whereas the people in the greengrocer shop are not likely to be members of trade union movements, therefore they have no interest whether there are more people working in the greengrocer shop or not. So is that how someone like the audience here should see that, or is there another explanation for this kind of... these examples you've been quoting tonight?
In terms of those examples, all that small business in particular is asking for, and this is across so many different industries, is a level playing field. That's all they want. They don't want preferable treatment. They don't want to be singled out, but they just want to be able to compete on the same level as many of the big businesses. And I think the penalty rates decision has really highlighted for the Australian public, who I have spoken to so many people who now say to me, Michaela, we actually had absolutely no idea that there was literally two systems within Australia. We did not realise that you could actually negotiate away penalty rates into, say, a rolled up rate if you're a big business and pay less on a Sunday. But if you're a small business, you don't have that same opportunity. So very much it does go back to Jared, the big businesses and the big unions being able to have certain flexibilities. Now, there's nothing wrong with flexibility. In fact, as a Liberal, the more flexibility that we can give every single person in this room, quite frankly, the better. But when the flexibility is ultimately then to the detriment of small business, which is over 93% of the businesses in this country, and you have an active political movement that says it's okay for the goose, but it's absolutely not in any way available to the gander, then you know you have a problem. And it's not about the greater economic good. It literally comes down to small business are the forgotten people versus those who have the power and the money to get what they want.
It's behind you, man. There's a question there.
Senator, just following on from that, do you think that with the ferocity of the Labor Party's response to the Fair Work Commission decision on penalty rates, that the government is in for the fight of its political life? Is it really vaguely reminiscent of the Work Choices legislation in terms of the political fight that you're now going to have to wage, even though this was a decision of an independent umpire? The sense that I had was, once it was announced that the government, in response to the ferocity of the Labor line, was backpedalling a little bit on and didn't want to defend it. But
no, absolutely not. We will defend that decision every step of the way. It is a decision of the independent umpire. There is a reason you have an independent umpire, in particular when it comes to the setting of wages and conditions. Can anybody here honestly imagine what it would be like if the Parliament was suddenly responsible for setting wages and conditions? Forget about getting anything else through, guys. Seriously, all we will be doing all day is debating whether it should go up, down, sideways, around a corner. And then how long's a piece of string? If Bill Shorten suddenly decides, well, you know, I didn't like what the Reserve Bank did either, because there are some people who are affected by that decision. Do we then also say, well, we're actually the arbiter of everything in the Parliament, so we will now also take on board setting the interest rates? There's a reason you have independence, and there is a reason you must defend it. I think what's so disappointing about the Labor Party's position, but in particular, that it just doesn't seem to be highlighted by the press. And, you know, with small business, I've spoken to Peter Strong of Cosboa. He actually issued a press release soon after the decision was handed down, and they advised their members not to go out and publicly defend the decision, because the CFMEU were already saying, we will basically close you down. That was when the CFMEU had said, we will come out and run the campaign on penalty rates. That is an absolute disgrace that small business would be bullied in to keeping their mouths shut. But in terms of Bill Shorten and Labor's hypocrisy, again, it goes back to, well, A, the personal hypocrisy that Bill Shorten really did make an art form in terms of negotiating away people's penalty rates. That is just, that is not me talking, that is me citing copious evidence. But also the fact that when it does come to defending the enterprise agreements, no journalist has actually really ever put Bill on the spot and said, if Sunday penalty rates are so sacrosanct, why do you condone unions, big unions and big employers, trading them away in an enterprise agreement? His whole argument falls away once he fails to acknowledge that that's exactly what is being done. So I can assure you, we will defend the decision every step of the way. But I have spoken to so many small business people who have personally said to me, Michaela, it's a modest change, but like the examples I cited tonight, it will enable us to either bring someone else on a Sunday and stop working for free. That's absolutely fantastic. To actually work additional hours, have other people come on to work additional hours on a Sunday, that is absolutely fantastic. And we will support that decision, but in particular, acknowledge the positive employment benefits that it will bring.
There's a question there, then we come here. Yes? You're speaking in the microphone.
So just to clarify your question, Gerard, to the Minister, you mentioned why the big employers or the big employers made agreements with the unions and went with some benefit to employment. It's got nothing to do with that, because the Domino's, the Pizza Hut, the Woolworths, whatever, they mainly employ school children. Right? So they get no benefit from this. It is simply the unions throwing their weight around, that, as far as I can see.
Can I just pick up on that point? And that is exactly why, in relation to the next piece of legislation that we've already introduced into the House of Representatives, and is now going to be, it will now be going to a Senate committee, as the majority of our legislation does. For me, it's the corrupting benefits legislation that is really key to addressing exactly what you have just put on the table. Stopping the money flowing from employers to unions. If it is not in the interests of the worker, if the worker is not themselves deriving a clear benefit from the money or the benefit, doesn't necessarily have to be money, being made here and going to here, then it's about time we all started questioning why the benefit is being offered and ultimately received. I have no issues whatsoever with legitimate payments being made. None at all. But we've been very clear in terms of what those legitimate payments are. And if you are negotiating an agreement, why shouldn't you have to disclose to the employees who are about to vote on the agreement the legitimate payments have been made? If they are legitimate payments, no one should be worried about disclosure. You only get worried if you're not meant to be doing it and suddenly you have to disclose it. If you're meant to be doing it, that's fantastic. Disclose it to the members, let them know, they can vote on the agreement and everybody can be happy. But you are very right in terms of benefits, and that's why we have the corrupting benefits legislation, the corrupting payments legislation.
Here.
Former Senator, I need to be careful now.
Not at all. In January this year, now former Vice President of the Fair Work Commission, Graham Watson, wrote to you informing you of his retirement. And in his letter, he said that business essentially regards the Fair Work system or the workplace relations system as a danger zone for business. Now, working with the Printing Industries Association, having done for our members workplace relations for 4.5 years, most of whom are small business, they do regard it as a danger zone. But in his letter, Mr. Watson also said that of the Fair Work Commission itself, that it's partisan, dysfunctional and divided. Now, you know Mr. Watson, eminent jurist, partner for 15 years at a competitor law firm to our hosts, and in the Fair Work Commission for almost 11 years as a vice president. Meanwhile, the government, as you have done appropriately a couple of times tonight in the context of the penalty rates decision and minimum rates, lauds the workplace relation, the Fair Work Commission, as the independent umpire. Now, in my humble
Mary
view, it cannot be twice, it cannot be both. So, Minister, who is right, divided, dysfunctional and partisan,
okay,
Mr. Watson or the government, and why?
Okay.
Thank you.
Allowed to answer it?
Yes.
Yep, sorry. At the end of the day, it is an independent commission. And certain comments have been made by a number of people, and the government is looking very seriously at those comments. But ultimately, the commission, and in particular the president, has a judicial capacity, and we obviously have a separation of powers. The government continues to make very strong appointments to the Fair Work Commission, people who are legally qualified, who understand the nature of industrial relations law, and I think will make a very, very significant contribution to decisions going forward, but based on an interpretation of the law, not giving favours to anybody. But I certainly acknowledge what former Vice President Watson has said, and as I said, we are looking at the issues that he has raised.
Question here.
Minister, thank you for your address. You made the remark about the inadequacy of monetary penalties.
Yes.
Have you perhaps considered empowering the courts to order remedial advertising, which will require publication at the union's expense of advertisements in whatever form the court sees fit, which will explain a flouting of the law by the union which has brought about the orders?
It's a very interesting point you raise, and no, we have not actually considered that. In the first instance, though, what we are doing, and in particular with the restoration of the Australian building and construction industry, is we have restored the penalties back to what they were under the former ABCC. One of the issues that was raised after the ABCC was abolished and in the conduct that ensued was very much, and the analogy that we use is this, the unions were literally behaving as if they were getting a parking fine. That's all it was for them. That is the contempt for which they had for the low penalties. They were not in any way a deterrence. We have now tripled those penalties. And I think any union would now have to think twice in terms of whether or not they want fines of that nature being made against them. Though in saying that, we're talking about unions here, in terms of our policy on exploitation, that is directed directly at employers, and we have just as significant fines in relation to employers. In terms of corrupting benefits, that legislation, that is directed towards both employers and unions, and we consider the giving or receiving of a corrupting benefit so significant, we will have a penalty of up to 10 years in jail. So I think in the first instance, it is very much ensuring that the penalties that are in place are adequate, and I believe the changes that we are making will certainly ensure that they are. But in terms of the broader point that you make, I'm personally often amazed at what I see on TV, and I'll give you the example. During the campaign for the ABCC, there was an absolutely disgraceful ad that was run on, I won't name the TV station, but it was by the CFMEU, and it was, "Ice dealers have more rights than workers on building sites." That is an absolute disgrace. And it should have, quite frankly, been called out by a lot of the major players in the building industry, and it wasn't. But that you are right, an explanation is sometimes warranted.
Yeah. That'll be brief now, we've run out.
Sorry, that means I've got to slow down and...
There, okay.
Sorry.
When you were listing the attribute and aspirations of the forgotten people of Menzies, it had a very familiar ring to it, because in a somewhat less elegant way, that's exactly the same speech that Pauline Hanson has been giving throughout the country. And in fact, probably one of the reasons why they've done well is because they've concentrated on that rather than the more lofty aspirations of Turnbull's talk. The question then is, there has been obviously an interaction between the Liberal Party and One Nation in West Australia, and I was just wondering if you'd like to comment on what you see as perhaps trying to get ground back from One Nation.
Just very briefly on that, and obviously Western Australian politics is obviously for the Western Australian division of the Liberal Party, but just in terms of my interaction with the crossbench generally, in the Senate, I will work with anyone and everyone, and in particular in relation to One Nation, I give them credit on the restoration of the Australian building and construction industry and the establishment of the Registered Organisations Commission. They were up front and they said, it is good law, we believe in it, it's good policy, that's it, full stop, you have our vote. I pay that.
Okay, there's a question there
at the
back. So
Minister,
okay.
Criminality, thuggery,
yes.
Blackmail, as
yep.
You've said, ongoing, proven, and sustainable. The entity that is the CMFEU actually is an enemy of the state. That might be inflammatory and exaggerated language, but I suggest it is very, very accurate. So, my question. Why the devil has not the government already made serious representations to have the CMFEU deregistered?
It's a very good question. One of the issues with deregistration, obviously, is the BLF were deregistered and they literally just came up again in another form that you have just alluded to. In terms of deregistering the CFMEU, it's actually only one part of the CFMEU that does the wrong thing. And it's obviously made up of a number of parts, and you would not want to disadvantage those members in terms of the other divisions that are basically doing the right thing. But going to your broader point, one of our next bills will address that directly, which will give the courts the ability to disqualify union officials who repeatedly break the law, just like company directors. Any company director in this room would know. Pretty much, I'm quite sure you know your obligations under the corpse law. And you make sure you abide by them, because if you don't, you know exactly what the penalty is. We will empower the courts to do the same thing, but we will also empower the courts to deregister or place into administration unions whose leadership has absolutely ripped off the workers or alternatively have continuously breached the law.
I'm going to read the two final questions. I'm one up the back. Yes.
Very briefly, Minister, over the years, many unions have produced some very nifty ads, most of us hate them, using professional actors, professional producers and so on. Why do you think the business community has failed so dismally in this same issue, the same field?
Look, and you'd obviously need more appropriately to direct the question to the business community, but you are right, and the penalty rates decision is the perfect example. The guy that stands up with Bill Shorten on the day that the decision came down was actually employed under an EBA and wasn't affected by it. But that didn't stop them standing there and saying, my God, this poor guy, oh my God, I'm not going to wait for the thing. What an absolute lie. And Bill Shorten stood there, knew that, and condoned what he was saying. In terms of the latest one with a lady called by the name of Margarita, that he's also been parading around, my understanding is that she's also not necessarily going to lose any money. And certainly her big employer, I understand, probably is not affected by the decision either. So here, on one hand, you've got the Labor Party and the unions who will blatantly lie when it comes to examples. I often find, though, that business like to do the right thing because they know there are consequences for doing the wrong thing. But when it comes in particular to small business, I went through this during the Australian Building and Construction Commission debates. The number of grown men and women, men in particular, I had in my office crying because of the bullying, the thuggery and the intimidation they were going through. And I would beg them and say, is there any way you can front a camera for me? And they would look at me and say, Michaela, my life, but what about my children? So you've got this tension. Those who are prepared to lie, exploit and do and say anything versus those who can't because of the consequences. And it's the tension, that's the tightrope we constantly walk.
Final brief question.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. We've heard a lot about current political.
Yep.
So I thought I might look at your views looking forward in your portfolio,
yes.
5, 10 and so forth years. Last week we had Trevor Hockey here talking about Trump, and a lot of people in America having many anxieties and uncertainties,
yep.
and feeling they're falling behind in their lives. And to some extent, that's happening in Australia too. Do you feel those anxieties and worries will play out in your portfolio looking forward 5, 10, 15 years?
The one thing you need to ensure in the employment portfolio is that the focus is on employment. So if there is a barrier or a disincentive to employment, the government should look at how you can remove that barrier. All of us in this room would agree that you must have a basic safety net of the minimum wage. All of us would agree that. That is something that we hold dear as Australians. But you need to have an employment system that is very much focused on. We need employers to grow. I always say to people, employers need employees and employees need employers. It is a relationship that without both parties, the relationship is not existent. So from this government's point of view, we want to see business, employers, small business in particular, to be as successful as possible. Because when they are successful, we can stand up and say there are more people in Australia who have a job. But at the same time, you can never, ever compromise wages and conditions. And I don't think anybody in this room would ever suggest that we should. So it's all about having a government that understands business. In fact, I often say, you need a government that understands. Governments don't create jobs. Employers do. What a government does, though, is put in place the framework in which employers operate. And we've got two choices. We can put in place a framework in which employers prosper and grow. And when an employer is prospering and growing, more Australians get jobs. And that's a good thing. Well, there's the alternative. You put in place a framework that doesn't acknowledge the role of employers, very much where the Labor Party's going down. You know, I often say the closest anyone in the Labor Party has ever come to a business is to proudly close it down. Do you know, and I've met, that's just an absolute disgrace. When you're talking about playing out worries over the next 5, 10 to 15 years, that would worry me as an Australian, that you have a Labor Party that does not understand the value and the role of employers. You need to understand as a government employers and what they need, whilst at the same time doing everything you can to protect employees. If you just focus on one or the other, you'll fail the system.
Many thanks, Minister. I know there were. Sorry, we couldn't take all the questions because we have to finish on time, but thanks to all of you for question time. Thanks also to the Minister. It was great to get a reminder that later this year is the 75th anniversary of Robert Menzies' most important radio broadcast in the series, the Forgotten People broadcast. I'm going to be very brief tonight, but I think it's important to record that Senator Cash is a senior minister who has had success in the Senate, and it's easy to talk about politics, but it's very hard to get results, and she's achieved that. I think tonight we've seen why, because she's able to communicate a message through examples, and this very complicated area of industrial relations, really all people understand as examples, and we've got some very good examples tonight.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.